Okay, take your time setting up, but I'll go ahead and call our last case. It is number 21-10948, Carlos Alfaro versus Bank of America. Okay, Mr. Kelston, you're on.
Thank you. May it please the court, Henry Kelston representing plaintiff appellants seeking reversal of the district court's order dismissing plaintiff's second amended complaint. Plaintiffs were among millions of customers of Bank of America NA, or BANA for short, who were charged a 3% international transaction fee on debit card transactions in violation of BANA's form deposit agreement. The case was extensively litigated prior to the dismissal by the district court. By the time the district court granted BANA's motion, the parties had fully briefed two motions to dismiss, two motions for class certification, and three summary judgment motions. The parties exchanged expert reports, filed Daubert motions, and briefed numerous evidentiary objections. When it granted the motion now on appeal, the district court had a full record on two pending motions for summary judgment and a pending motion for class certification, comprising hundreds of pages.
Counsel, I would not relitigate this. I understand your frustration, and maybe things should have been done differently, but let's get to the meat of it.
Yes, Your Honor. The complaint alleges that plaintiffs received two contract documents when they opened their accounts, the deposit agreement and disclosures, and the incorporated personal schedule of fees, which together constituted the entire deposit agreement. Most important,
those documents said that other account documents could also contain fees, did they not?
There was a single reference to the possibility of fees appearing in another document in the section called electronic disclosures, which was far from clear that it was referring to the possibility of an international transaction fee for debit card transactions. And in any event, even if one takes it to mean it could have referred to a separate agreement, it directly conflicts with numerous statements in the deposit agreement that said all of the fees were in the schedule of fees.
Tell me where the word all appears.
The word all doesn't appear, but
right.
But
you've added that word, right? In your briefing and in here, you've added that word.
We haven't added that word to the contract language. We've said that contract language that says repeatedly the fees are in the schedule of fees.
The fees for the deposit account, the personal deposit account, right?
Right.
But this isn't the personal deposit account. This applies the way the agreement says is there is separate provisions, and there's even a separate, literally a block of separate provisions for electronic banking services, which include ATM and debit cards. And as to that, this is the question Judge Jordan asked you. It says, quote, for other fees that apply to electronic banking services, please review the schedule, the one you referenced, and each agreement or disclosure that we provided to you for the specific electronic banking service, including ... the separate agreement for ATM and debit cards. Right?
That is the language of the contract, but read with in context of all the provisions of the contract, we believe the contract is clear that that the account holders are directed to the schedule of fees to look at the fees. And in fact, the schedule of fees contained all the fees, including fees related to debit card use.
And that's not inconsistent there. That provision I just read you says the other fees for banking, electronic banking services will be in the schedule of fees, the one you just referenced, and these other agreements, right? That's not inconsistent.
It's also not inconsistent with the interpretation of the statements that the fees are in the schedule of fees to take those statements to mean that all the fees are in the schedule of fees. And we certainly submit that that is at least a plausible reading of the language in the contract, which is all that the complaint needs to satisfy to survive the motion to dismiss.
I think this is only my personal view. I think that you are right about one thing, and that is that the district court's preemption analysis was too broad. So I don't read the Truth in Savings Act and its preemption regulation and preemption provision to bar a claim for pure breach of contract. So for example, if a bank says, listen, for a normal checking account, if you have a $1,000 minimum daily balance, you have no fees. But if you drop below $1,000, even one day, you have a $5 fee. And then all of a sudden, you're at $3,000 every single day and you get hit with a $15 fee. That's a breach of contract. I don't think that's inconsistent with TISA. And I think you can sue on that pure breach of contract claim. So I think in that respect, you are more right than Bank of America is about preemption. My concern is the merits, because I just don't see how you have a breach of contract claim here, given the provisions that Judge Luck just cited to you. I mean, you referred to them in your complaint. You included, I think, some plan documents that post-dated the events in question, but Bank of America submitted the ones that were temporally relevant in their response, which is permissible. And those documents indicate that your clients were aware that these ATM fees for international transactions could be imposed. So I don't see where the breach is. Maybe you can tell me where I'm missing something.
Well, yes, I believe I can. Again, we're talking about a plausible claim stated in the complaint on a motion to dismiss. Schedule paragraph 15 of the complaint quotes six statements from the deposit agreement and alleges that these statements describe the statement of fees as containing an exhaustive list of account fees. The statements include such as the personal schedule of fees describes our personal accounts and lists account fees.
It's the counsel for me, it's the personal account qualifier, because the contract seems to have a separate discussion of what is required and disclosed for personal accounts, separate and apart from the electronic banking services. Isn't that how a fair reading of the contract?
It's a fair reading of the contract, perhaps if one has a working knowledge of the distinctions between personal deposit accounts and electronic banking services.
Well, no one's more financially illiterate than me, but I'm just saying, as someone who actually opened it up and read it, there seems to be separate provisions that apply for, like the language you just read applies for personal deposit accounts. And then separately it says, here's the provisions and language dealing with electronic banking services, which includes ATM and debit cards. And there are separate agreements for those, right?
But this fee does relate to personal deposit accounts, because it's the personal deposit account from which the bank takes the fee. It's not unrelated to personal deposit accounts, as if you get a debit card that's not connected to your account.
But it's for use of the debit or credit card that triggers the fee, right? In other words, I have to use my bank-issued credit card in my nice trip to Paris at the cafe to get a baguette, and that's when the 3% transaction fee is hit, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So I'm trying to understand, and I'll go back to the question that Judge Jordan asked you, is how can I fairly read the contract to be such that it doesn't disclose that there are other fees and other agreements related specifically to the ATM and debit cards?
Well, one provision in the schedule of fees says the schedule of fees lists account fees. Other account fees that can apply are listed in the account descriptions and the other account fees section, referring to sections in the schedule of fees itself. every monthly statement that went to account holders said, when you opened your account, you received a deposit agreement and fee schedule and agreed that your account would be governed by the terms of these documents, as we may amend them from time to time. The only reference in the account agreement to extrinsic documents was to unspecified other documents. There's no specific reference to electronic transaction agreements or the debit card agreement or to additional fees that will be taken from your personal deposit account that are disclosed in some other place.
If that's right, where do you think the 3% fee is taken from? Where else would it be taken from except from your account?
Of course it is taken from your personal deposit account. And that's...
What's confusing about that part of it? Because it seems to me that part of what you're arguing in the brief, right, both in your breach of contract and your unconscionability argument is that these fees were not adequately disclosed, that they were somehow hidden. As a result, your clients and people like him did not provide consent, that the agreements were ineffective, confusing, deceptive, unfair, and misleading. So
that is all true, and we allege all of that. But the crux of the claim is that BANA had obligated itself by contract to disclose the fees in the schedule of fees because it repeatedly told people that's where the fees are listed. And all fees were listed there except for one, an international transaction fee, which was not disclosed in any way to plaintiffs when they opened their account, when they entered into the deposit agreement. There is some other agreement that they received, arguably, BANA claims, sometime later when they received in the mail their card, but that was heavily litigated below, and there are significant questions about whether that agreement was ever sent, whether it was received, whether they assented to the terms in the agreement. Certainly, on the basis of the allegations in the complaint, which have to be interpreted in the light most favorable to the plaintiffs, there is a plausible claim that the language in the agreement can be read as directing people to the schedule of fees, and that's where the international transaction fee should have been disclosed. And ultimately, that's exactly where it was disclosed. It was put into that section in the schedule of fees that already had some credit card, some debit card related fees in it. But that was not until May of 2015, years after the plaintiffs had opened their accounts.
Does your complaint say that your client never received the document that listed the 3% fee?
Yes.
It says you never got it?
Yes.
Where?
I want to say paragraph 22. It alleges that based on the bank's account opening procedures and its debit card distribution procedures, that neither plaintiffs nor other class members received that document.
Can I ask you a question? Does it matter for your claim? In other words, as I read your claim, it goes back to what you said right at the opening, which is our claim is the contract said that all fees had to be disclosed in the schedule, and this wasn't disclosed in the schedule. And if we, reading the contract, disagree with that reading, in other words, we don't find it to be a reasonable reading of the contract or it's ambiguous in some way. In other words, that a fee could be disclosed elsewhere. It doesn't really matter that they didn't receive the elsewhere. It just matters that not all fees are in the schedule and it was somewhere else, right?
On the contract claim, I would agree that it doesn't matter.
And I'm only talking on the contract claim.
Okay. On the unjust enrichment claim and unconscionability claim, I think it could matter.
I agree. That's all I have, Judge.
Okay. All right. Thank you. You've saved your time for rebuttal. Mr. Pegg.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Alan Pegg of Hogan Lovells on behalf of Bank of America. Normally, I'd like to start our discussion, I think, in the logical place, which is preemption, before we turn to the merits. But I think I'd take the Court up on its implicit offer to talk about the merits, as Your Honor did with...
I want to target you where I'm having a little bit of concern.
Of course.
And there's two claims that I'm a little troubled by on the merits, and then we can talk about preemption with regard to those two claims. Claim number one is the good faith claim, or the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing with regard to the notice class, not with regard to the disclosure of the fee class, but the notice class. Because I agree with you on a breach of contract theory that the notice says we ordinarily do this and we may do this, and if it's required by law, and if it's not, we may not do it. So I agree with you that I read the contract similar to how you do on a breach of contract theory. But given that there's discretion in that, the ordinarily and we reserve the right, that would seem to trigger an implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing with regard to when you have to exercise that discretion.
Understood, Your Honor. But the thing is about an implied covenant claim, even though it's based on an exercise of discretion, it still has to be tied to the breach of an express provision.
Agreed.
The provision, so in order to find that sufficiently states a claim on the implied covenant, we would have to first find that there was an underlying provision that said that all of the fees are only going to be disclosed exhaustively, exclusively, whatever word we may use, in the deposit agreement and the personal schedule of fees.
I'm talking about the notice claim, not the... I agree with you on the schedule claim. The notice claim is you didn't tell it in May 2015 when you did put it in the schedule, you didn't let us know, right? That's the notice claim?
That's the notice claim.
Right. I'm talking about that claim. Because there, the language that's relied on, I'm going to read it to you, with a few dot, dot, dots in there. We may change this agreement at any time. We may add new terms, dot, dot, dot. We ordinarily send you advance notice of an adverse change in this agreement. However, we may make changes without prior notice unless otherwise required by law. We may, but do not have to notify you of changes that we make for security reasons or that we believe are either beneficial or not adverse to you. There's a lot of discretion in there, and so I agree that the failure to do so is not a breach of that provision. But that discretion does implicate, it seems to me under Florida law, implied covenants of good faith and fair dealing in that disclosure. And so why is that not a valid claim to say you were, as a matter of good faith and fair dealing, supposed to give us a heads up on this thing?
Because, Judge, it's not a plausible reading to find that the bank's decision to notify the customers in an additional place of a fee that they had already told the customers that they were going to be assessed was an adverse change or even any change whatsoever that would trigger some sort of implied covenant of good faith to tell you once again, I've already told you for years on end, including when you opened your account, that we're going to assess this fee, and now we're giving you an additional disclosure and we have some breach of an implied covenant that we didn't tell you once again, that not only did we tell you originally, but we told you.
Except that the allegations are, as your opposing counsel just said, we never did receive the separate agreement. So we take that as true. They never received it that had this other disclosure. That doesn't matter for me for the breach of contract because all we're talking about there is whether the schedule was required to list all and not all. I agree with you. It's not required to list all, not all. But if they're saying we never got this thing and the only notice we got was when I went to use it after 2015 and I looked at it and now it's there and it wasn't there, that would seem, again, to trigger under Florida law an implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing.
But what they do allege, Judge Luck, that they got is the next monthly statement after May 8th of 2015. And that monthly statement, as alleged, contains a disclaimer that says, or a provision, I should say, that says you have access to the personal schedule of fees and the deposit agreement on Bank of America's website. And so that, as of May 8th, 2015, did give them the disclosure of the additional disclosure, I should add.
There's two issues with that. One is that's really not the basis that the district court granted dismissal on. I'm not even sure that's what was argued to the district court. And two, that seems to be a plausibility issue. Is it plausible that they didn't know based on that disclosure? Your opposing counsel says that never talks about the other agreements. It just talks about the personal service fee and the fee schedule. And it doesn't talk about anything else, and that really didn't give us the notice that we need. I'm not sure that doesn't fit into the plausibility issue there. But I do want you to talk about preemption in a second regarding that, because I think you do have probably a really good argument on preemption with regard to good faith and fair dealing. One other merits issue that I want to talk about is the unconscionability claim. Because the way that I understand the district court dismiss it is that, A, it didn't exist under Florida law, and B, to the extent it existed, they allege some sort of damages in there. I have to say
they sought damage.
That's right.
It was not an affirmative standalone claim, and also to the extent it could be under the debatable law, it can't seek damages, rather purely equitable.
That's right, because it's illegal damages. So with regard to its existence, it seems to me that while there may not be something standalone called unconscionability, that in a deck action under Florida law, you can argue that a contract provision is unlawful because it's unconscionable. Do you agree with that?
I do agree with that, Your Honor.
Did they sufficiently allege a deck action?
They did not. Not only did they not sufficiently allege it, they didn't even try to allege it. But I had the same thought, Judge.
Well, it's not an original thought. Judge King wrote it in the overdraft case, so I don't want to take credit for his thought. But
I'll give it to you nonetheless.
Okay.
So, Your Honor, to address the unconscionability merits argument, right, it's twofold. One, it's not an affirmative standalone claim, as the cases we cited, Barricat from the Florida 4th DCA and Sherwin-Williams from the Southern District of Florida, and it shouldn't be. I had a sort of intellectual curiosity as to why this shouldn't be a standalone claim, and the cases discussing the open issue of this under Florida law don't actually go into the reasoning, but I did a little poking, and it's because, in my belief, unconscionability came up as a creature of equity, and it came up as a purely defensive measure in courts of equity, and it eventually made its way into the UCC, where it probably
and that completely makes sense. Someone alleges a breach of contract against you, you defend to say, yeah, I signed the contract, but it's completely unconscionable, and no, under public policy, you can't enforce this thing. I mean, that's how this is normally going to come up. So, but I'm interrupting you. Go ahead.
Not at all, Judge. And so that's why, as a matter of how it evolved, this concept, this doctrine, this principle of unconscionability, while it is entirely applicable and available as a defensive measure, it's never been recognized or shouldn't be recognized as an affirmative claim. And even if it was, it's an equitable issue. You can't seek legal damages, and that's precisely what they pled in their complaint.
So they use the word damages. There's no doubt about that. But if you dig deep in Florida cases going back a ways, damages is a pretty broad term that can encompass things like disgorgement and restitution, which are equitable remedies and not legal remedies. And that seems at the pleading stage a really, really hyper-technical way when damages could be read, when money can be given in equitable claims to kick it on that ground because they use the term damages, along with, by the way, a bunch of other equitable remedies that they were seeking.
Right. So, Your Honor, I haven't, it wasn't brief, so I haven't looked into the history of Florida law and federal law in terms of...
This issue was raised by the district court. I mean, this is fair game.
I understood, Judge, but what I would say is that in their second amended complaint, the plaintiffs themselves obviously were drawing a distinction between damages in the pure legal monetary sense and equitable relief. In their prayer for relief, they ask for both, in the ultimate prayer for relief. So
right,
they're
but what
not,
I'm saying
they're
is damages, Florida has used the term damages to refer to things like restitution and things like disgorgement. I agree it may be loose language, but there is cases which use damages to describe those things, which are clearly equitable.
And I would say, Judge, we're going off what the plaintiffs themselves in their third pleading, the second amended complaint, meant by damages. And they obviously didn't mean damages to include all sorts of underlying equitable relief because they separately pled and prayed for other equitable relief. So they were seeking damages in the legal monetary sense, and they were seeking equitable relief in the other historical court of equity sense.
All right. Let's assume for the moment, I'm just assuming it, that I disagree with you and think the district court got wrong on the merits, those two claims I discussed with you, the breach of implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing with regard to the notice class and the unconscionability claims. Tell me why they are preempted under TISA.
Sure. And I think it was Judge Jordan who made a comment at the outset that the district court perhaps got it a bit too broad. And I would say not so if we place the preemption analysis and preemption decision in context, because I want to be clear what we're not saying this case stands.
Can I stop you just a little bit? I would not defend the breach of contract, the preemption on breach of contract. I just don't think that's necessary for you. And I'm really focused on those claims where I think there might be an issue on the merits. So tell me why, even if the district court did too broadly do it on the breach of contract context, got it right with regard to breach of the good faith duty of good faith and fair dealing and regarding any unconscionability claim to the extent it exists.
Sure, because in order to undertake the analysis on TISA preemption, we need to figure out whether or not there's conflict between what the plaintiffs allege and what they're asking the court to require BANA to do and what TISA allows for. And here there is direct conflict between the provisions of Regulation DD and the allegations, one, that we somehow breached an implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing by not giving them separate notice, and by—
In other words, the TISA regulations, they just say it has to be in a conspicuous place and accessible, or it has to be in a clear and presented, and it has to be in some sort of schedule that you're given. And it doesn't tell you it needs to be done in good faith and needs to be fair dealing or added any individual duties to that. Right?
And it actually goes one step further, Judge Luck. The TISA, the Regulation DD provisions, and I'll cite them for the court, actually allow banks to do exactly what they say that we shouldn't have done in these two claims. And that is to, one, put a fee in a separate document. And 12 CFR 1030.3A allows disclosures of fees to be in separate documents, just like they say we shouldn't have done via these two claims. They also say that you needed to provide it contemporaneously. That's the actual allegation in paragraph 22 and 21, that they weren't provided the card agreement contemporaneously. Well, that also, and it was a breach of implied covenant of good faith, and it was unconscionable for us not to have done so. That's also addressed in Regulation DD in 1030.4, and that allows that a document can be provided within 10 business days after a given account is open or a service is provided. So, and it makes sense. If somebody goes into a bank branch, think of it, and they say, I want to open a personal deposit account. I'm going to get my documentation there. I'm going to give you $100. That's my account. And I want a debit card. Well, the debit card doesn't get printed at the branch and given right there. It comes in the mail. And when it comes in the mail, obviously before you can possibly use it, it comes with here the card agreement. And that's what Regulation DD 1030.4 of 12 CFR allows a bank to do.
What about inconsistency with regard to notice in what they're alleging is the duty of good faith and fair dealing with regard to notice?
In what sense, Judge Love?
So they're alleging that you were required to tell us at the time that you made the change in May of 2015 that you now put it on the schedule, that you were required to notify us. How is that inconsistent with anything in Regulation DD or the statute?
That's inconsistent with 12 CFR 1030.4C1, which allows, upon a change in fees, the notice, and I'm quoting here, shall state that consumers may request account disclosures containing terms, fees, and rate information for their account. And that is exactly what the monthly account statement that the plaintiffs alleged they received the month after May 8th, 2015, the change, that's exactly what that monthly account statement said. You may request a copy of the disclosures containing terms, fees, and rate information, that, in this particular context, being the new personal schedule of fees.
So there's no requirement that it be done, the Regulation DD and the statute don't require that it be done right at the time that it's made. In other words, when they print out the newest schedule, you don't need to immediately tell people, you can do it based on some monthly notice or something like that.
That's exactly what 1030.4C1 says, Your Honor.
Mr. Peck, can I just ask you a housekeeping matter, and I'll ask your friend on the other side the same thing when he stands up for rebuttal. But my understanding from your answer brief is that you allege that they've abandoned their arguments with regards to Bank of America Corporation. Is
correct.
That accurate? Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
So we have to write an opinion on this case, which may go to preemption, may go to the merits, maybe a little bit of each. And so although from what I've said, and I think what Judge Luck said, I think I share his view that a pure breach of contract claim is not preempted by TISA. But I want to give you the chance to convince me that my initial instinct is wrong. In other words, the bank decides what fee it's going to put and how it's going to disclose it. I give you all of that. But if the fee is X and then you charge Y, I don't see why a consumer can't sue in a pure breach of, and I know this one is different. I know the allegation and the causal chain for the breach of contract thing is different. But in that sort of a case, why does TISA preempt?
Sure, Judge. And I'm going to start off with an admission that I think a pure breach of contract claim, or as the case law at times calls it, a genuine breach of contract claim, is not preempted by TISA. If that's what the second amended complaint had pled, like the original complaint pled in the charging of international transaction fees in connection with the PayPal transactions, that claim is not preempted. But Judge, that's not what the second amended complaint pleads. It's not a, you promised to give all fees in the deposit agreement or an exhaustive list of fees in the deposit agreement and the personal schedule of fees, period, full stop. You then charged me additional fees. That's a breach of contract. That would not be preempted. What the claim is here is that you had a list of some fees in the deposit agreement and in the schedule of fees. We read into it that there should be some words of exclusivity. And that they don't stop there. They say, and we recognize paragraph 22 of the second amended complaint that the card agreement all along, including prior to May 2015, did disclose the ITF. But they say it was a breach of contract for two reasons. One, because it was in a separate agreement, the card agreement, not the deposit agreement. And two, it didn't come along with our account opening. But counsel, that's what Regulation DD preempts.
But counsel, that seems to go to the merits. In other words, whether I tend to agree with you on the merits that the contract doesn't say all fees are going to be in the schedule. But assume with me it did. Their allegation seems to me that the failure to put it there, even though it's in some other thing that they got, is itself a breach.
But that's what Regulation DD preempts.
I know, but a bank is allowed to go above and beyond what the statute allows. A bank is allowed to promise to say, we know this is the floor. I am going to give you more. The breach of doing that is complete, seems to me to be completely separate from what is the regulations require. Now, on the common law claims, those are fair game. But on the breach of contract, and this is true if you look at the airline deregulation preemptions and a bunch of other preemptions, where there's a contract that gives you greater protection and there's a breach of those greater protections, those seem to not be subject to preemption.
Yeah, and I don't think that for purposes of our analysis, we can surgically separate the breach of contract analysis on the merits from the preemption, because you need to figure out what they are actually pleading in the second amended complaint in order to determine whether or not, one, it's preempted, and two, it fails on the merits.
Your argument is, I think, that their breach of contract claim is preempted because it is not really a true breach of contract claim, but it is a mixture of contractual and notice and equitable type issues, and that's the sort of stuff that TISA speaks to.
I think that's a fair summary, Judge. What I would say is that their claim goes to a challenge to the adequacy, method, and fairness of the disclosure of the ITF. They package it in the veneer, as the courts have used the term, to try to get around preemption. They package it in the veneer of a breach of contract claim. But at core, it goes to the adequacy, method, and sufficiency of disclosure. And that's precisely what Regulation DD preempts. So again, we're not asking the court to issue some broad proclamation that commitments about fees or declarations about where you can find what in our contract documents are always preempted. We're not asking for that. We're simply asking, and we're arguing, that based on the allegations and their formulation of their contract claims in the second amended complaint, the way they've pled them, do fall under Regulation DD preemption.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Pegg.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, Mr. Kelson, you've got your rebuttal time.
Thank you. First, with regard to the last point that counsel discussed about the genuineness of the contract claim, BANA's position essentially would free them from any breach of contract claim relating to fees, no matter what kind of promise was made in the contract. they would be able to say, no, this is really about how the fee was disclosed. It's not about the contract. That's just a veneer to get around preemption. And that's far too broad. And as the amicus brief mentioned, that sweeping that wide in preemption of contract claims would do significant harm to consumers' ability to enforce their rights under contracts. I would also point out that Judge King in Ray Checking Account ruled that damages are available for unconscionability claims, because if the plaintiff prevailed on the unconscionability claim, the court would have the authority to impose equitable remedies that would include monetary damages for the bank's enforcement of the unconscionable clause. In addition, as we briefed, the fact that we requested declaratory relief and other equitable relief undermines any rationale that the fact that we mentioned damages should lead to dismissal of the entire claim. In terms of unconscionability developing as a defense to contract claims, that's generally true. But as Judge King wrote and other courts have also written, in a situation like this, where the bank has already taken the money from the account, ostensibly under the contract, the only ability the account holder has to challenge the contract as unconscionable is in an affirmative action to get the money back. Also, in terms of the timing of the notice of the change, counsel referred to a 10-day allowance under the regulation. There's nothing in the complaint relating to the number of days after account opening that Vanna claims to have provided notice. That's certainly a factual issue that needs to be explored in the district court, but not on a motion to dismiss. Finally,
30 seconds to wrap up.
Sure. They claim that the change in the schedule of fees was not an adverse change because the fee had been disclosed in the other document. And aside from the factual question about whether that was ever received, and that is in paragraph 22 of the complaint, it is not inconsistent with the regulation to require the adverse change, as the contract said, in advance of the adverse change to the schedule to the deposit agreement. The fact that the bank may have provided that notice sometime later doesn't remedy the breach of the contract for failure to provide the notice in accordance with the contract terms.
Okay, Mr. Kelson.
Thank you.
We've got your argument. Mr. Pegg, thank you very much as well. And we are in recess for today.